From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. State of Belief airs every weekend on radio stations nationwide and is available as a podcast on iTunes and other leading podcast platforms. I urge you to subscribe to it today. This program is made possible in great part by the generous support of our listeners. If you've made a donation this week, I say thank you, thank you. Now, if you haven't pitched in yet, information on how you can help keep this show on the air is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Now, here's what's coming up on this week's State of Belief Radio.
We only have 1 million hospital beds in this country. We have 65,000 ventilators for the whole country. Almost all of them are at use right now, particularly during flu season. If this really kicks up, we're going to see hospitals in this country, in particular places, overwhelmed. And scenes like we're seeing in Italy right now, people in the hallways, you know, people just not being able to get care.
As the global pandemic continues to intensify, governments are struggling to both react and contain the coronavirus. While many things remain unclear, many experts agree that the crisis in Italy is a likely model for what's coming next in the United States. On this week's show, we'll get a first-person account from Elisa D. Benedetta, co-managing director of the International Association of Religion Journalists.
The world has made a lot of progress against hunger, poverty, and disease over the last few decades. More progress is clearly possible. I see this as the great exodus from our time, an exodus from hunger.
Since 1991, the Reverend Dr. David Beckman has been a leading advocate for global anti-hunger programs. As he retires after almost 3 decades as president of Bread for the World, David will be with us for a look back at some highlights of a distinguished career. But first,
nobody wants to hurt each other anymore, right? And they're being politically correct the way they take them out. So it takes a little bit longer. And honestly, protesters, they realize it. They realize that there are no consequences to protesting anymore.
This is the core of Donald Trump's ideology. The protesters who interrupted his rally, the political correctness that kept police from cracking their skulls, the media that always seems to take their side, this is what is keeping America from being great again.
We live in a country of 360 million people. There is no chance to know our leaders or even most of our neighbors in person. And so we have to rely on communication, words and language, to understand the world we live in and the decisions being made in our name. Often, it may seem that the loudest voice is the one that gets heard. But there are inherent risks in communication that may indeed be meant to be heard, but that can inspire concrete action as well. Now, none of this is new, but that fact makes it no less potentially dangerous. In-depth analysis of the process will appear this summer in the form of an important new book, Words on Fire: The Power of Incendiary Language and How to Confront It. Now, I consider this topic to be so urgent that I didn't want to wait until publication, especially since the author's longtime commitment to the Interfaith Alliance Board of Directors makes it harder for him to elude our scheduling staff. And so I'm happy to welcome that author, Helio Fred Garcia, back to State of Belief Radio. Fred, thank you for being willing to say yes to this.
Thank you for the invitation, Walton. Honored to be on the program.
We had a brief conversation about this critical issue last year on the show. At that time, we were using the term stochastic terrorism, which you now say is not helpful. Would you talk about why and what better language for this is there?
Well, thank you. In the aftermath of the 9/11 attacks, social scientists and experts on terrorism began to use the phrase stochastic terrorism to refer to acts of violence and mass violence that are provoked by language and that lead people to act on the language and commit violence. And the word stochastic has to do with a principle from statistics and physics of something being statistically predictable, even if it isn't individually predictable. So what stochastic terrorism says is you can anticipate that certain kinds of language will lead to violence with high degrees of predictive precision. You just can't agree that this individual will commit this act of violence against that other individual. That's the principle, and it is relatively commonly discussed in national security, law enforcement, terrorism, and social science circles. The challenge is, to a non-expert audience, that's a very difficult word to say. It's a difficult word to understand, and people's eyes tend to glaze over. So what I have done is to focus not on the statistical probability, but I describe that, but rather I look at who is it who acts on the communication, what is it that they are acting on, and what do they do as a result? And what the national security anti-terrorism literature describes is the people who are motivated to commit acts of violence on hearing communication are essentially lone wolves. They are not part of any active terrorist network. They are individuals acting alone. They plan alone. They equip alone. They choose their targets alone. They are not directed to do something specifically, but they are inspired to do something generally. So I begin that the actor who commits the violence is the lone wolf.
The toughest rhetorical bridge to cross is that from word to action. And you make a compelling case for this. And I want you to go on and explain that point as well.
So the starting point is to know who is it who commits the violence. The second step is to identify what is it that inspires the lone wolf. And it's a communication from a charismatic, dynamic speaker through a medium that has emotional resonance. And that communication may not be recognized by all people as dangerous communication. And so it serves as a kind of dog whistle, as we understand dog whistle politics in the United States. It is recognized by some, and some act on that recognition. So I refer to this as lone wolf whistles, and violence committed by lone wolves who are responding to the lone wolf whistle, I describe as lone wolf whistle violence. And when that violence isn't random, but is planned carefully against a mass target, I call that lone wolf whistle terrorism. One of the challenges of the old words stochastic terrorism is it didn't seem to anticipate insult, exclusion, and violence up to terrorism. But the phenomenon, as we trace the language that has been in the political sphere in the last 5 years and the reactions to that language, is it begins with disinhibition of insult. It moves to acts of random, apparently spontaneous violence against people in suspect groups. And then it ultimately leads to the act of fatal violence and ultimately terrorism. I call acts of random or opportunistic violence triggered by language lone wolf whistle violence. And then when it becomes significant enough to be an act of planned violence against a large group of people, I call that lone wolf whistle terrorism.
So how do we avoid the pitfalls of comparing today's hateful rhetoric to historic examples of similar rhetoric leading to deadly consequences, because we both know a lot of people tune out from that kind of conversation.
The immediate comparison to past genocides is a politically sensitive comparison, and I'm acutely aware of that. Having said that, in my study of communication and leadership and history, I have identified 12 forms of communication that predictably lead to acts of violence and that historically have led to acts of genocide, and that are often implicated in acts of terror. And I did a systematic assessment with the help of some very gifted researchers, a systematic assessment of the forms of language that historically precede acts of violence, including genocide. And what troubled me as I was hearing the political discourse during the campaign and during the first years of the president's presidency is the forms of language seemed familiar. As I began to dig deeply into the book, I found the patterns that were unmistakable and that are actually easy to recognize once you know what to look for. So these 12 forms of communication, I call the lone wolf whistle terrorist playbook. And if you like, I can describe some or all of these 12 forms of communication.
I am interested in knowing, having you talk about at least two or three of those, because these are, if I understand it correctly, identifiable steps that can take words and lead to mass violent action.
They are exactly that. And what I try to do in the book is to describe the phenomenon, show that it is present in our world today, describe how we got here, and then give us a path forward that allows civic leaders and engaged citizens to recognize it early, to name it quickly, and to demand that those who use this kind of language be aware of and responsible for the consequences. I looked at the Nazi genocide, I looked at the Rwandan massacre of Tutsi by the Hutu, and I looked at the current political climate. The first is to dehumanize a suspect group, and that dehumanization includes calling them animals, calling them specific kinds of animals, rats, vermin, calling them an infestation. We saw that in the genocides of the Nazis. We saw that in the genocide of the Hutu against the Tutsi. There, the Hutu referred to the Tutsi as cockroaches and even said a cockroach will never evolve into a butterfly, meaning that they were destined to be vermin. We saw President Trump as candidate and as president refer to Mexican immigrants as animals, refer to their presence as an infestation. He was using exactly the same forms of language. And not only does referring to them as animals dehumanize members of that group, but one of the things I describe in the book is that kind of language conditions a society to be less empathetic towards members of that group and more normalizing of acts that would otherwise be seen as inhumane. So when you see the people who have been described as animals and their presence as an infestation being held in squalid cages and children separated from their parents, that is a predictable consequence as government policy of labeling human beings less than human. And that's the first play in the lone wolf whistle terrorism playbook, to dehumanize. Another is to severely exaggerate the nature of the threat. So starting in the spring of 2018, President Trump described migrants who were essentially immigrants who have internationally protected, international law protected rights. He referred to them as an invasion. And that invasion, he said, was created by governments intentionally sending their worst people to the United States to wreak havoc. And he said that the invaders were infiltrated by Middle Easterners who were also trying to sneak in through the caravan, and that the caravan was funded by sinister-sounding people in order to destabilize the United States. The people he was talking to and referring to as an invasion were essentially refugees without any resources, struggling to escape abject poverty and violence and famine to get their children to a safer place. And instead of treating them as refugees, they were labeled an imminent threat to the United States. The United States military was mobilized, even though the military under American law is not permitted to engage in immigration activities or law enforcement activities. And just to show that this was all for political benefit, the military deployed to Texas, even though the destination of the so-called caravan of invaders was San Diego, 1,500 miles away. But that persistent pounding on invader, invasion, imminent threat intensified and accelerated through the campaign. And President Trump used some form of invader or invasion 5 to 7 times in the normal course of the early part of the midterm election campaign. But by the last weeks, he was using some form of invader or invasion fully 35 to 40 times a day. And every time he would say it, it would be amplified in social media and white supremacist media. And that's where I began sending out signals on social media in October 2018 about stochastic terrorism. And I said, someone is going to be killed by this language of invader. And sure enough, 10 days before the election, a white supremacist went into the Tree of Life synagogue fully armed, and he killed 11 people. He wounded many others. And what is fascinating to me, and I cover this in the book, is he, 10 days before he attacked the synagogue, posted on his white supremacist site, "I see we've stopped calling them illegal aliens. We now call them invaders. I like this." He then got more and more agitated in social media posts saying that the Jews were funding the invasion and we've got to stop it. And then he targeted a particular organization, the Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society, and said they are the ones who are bringing the invaders in. And on the day of the shooting, he posted, I'm tired of Hayas bringing in invaders to slaughter our people. Screw the optics. I'm going in. And 2 hours later, he committed the act of terror. He was clearly triggered by the language of invasion. He had never committed an act of violence before. He was using the very language that the president had used and that had been amplified in mainstream media, in social media, and then in white supremacist media. It was that event that compelled me to stop what I was doing and to begin to study this phenomenon more carefully and more thoroughly. And here we are 15, 16 months later, and I've turned it into a book not only about the phenomenon, but about how to recognize it and how to stop it.
Despite the coronavirus crisis being a new challenge facing humanity, I can't help but think of how well the principles you're talking about apply to this moment of terror and uncertainty. What are the ways a demagogue would try to leverage this moment to consolidate even more power?
Well, we have seen that happening from initially saying that the problem was with people in China, and as a result, people from China became more and more at risk. And what one of the things that we have seen is a rise in incivility, first against people based on the perception of their national origin, and second on what they happen to be wearing over their faces. And the language that the virus itself is a democratic hoax is extraordinarily dangerous. And there are people who believe it. And one of the things I do in the book is I talk about why do people believe that kind of thing. It's a process called motivated reasoning. But in terms of the language that is happening today, when the president labels the disease, a foreign virus, well, viruses don't have nationality. But labeling it a foreign disease means anyone from somewhere else is suddenly suspect. The other language that he uses is the language of travel ban. And as a commentator said on television recently, when the only solution you have is a wall, everything is framed as an invasion. The idea that the travel ban is the solution, as opposed to lack of adequate testing and treatment alternatives and hospital beds, et cetera, is from a public health standpoint extremely dangerous, but from a social cohesion standpoint, even more dangerous. And one of the things we saw in the president's recent Oval Office address was his referring to the need to stop people from coming from different parts of the world. And then he said, oh, there will be exceptions. We saw exactly the same thing during the campaign when he called for a total and complete ban of Muslims entering the United States. And then when he was pressed on it, he said, oh, well, the good ones will be allowed in. Americans will be allowed in. Well, how could it be total and complete if certain people will be allowed in, but you don't tell us what the criteria are? When he did the actual travel ban as president, he initially banned people with green cards. And the government was completely confused about whether people with green cards could come in or not. And ultimately, they changed that travel ban. But travel ban seems to be the go-to tool for this particular president, but it is, from a policy perspective, incoherent. Why is he doing that? I can't attribute motive, but I can say that one of the predictable consequences, we saw it during the call for Muslims not being allowed to enter the country, we saw it during the actual travel ban in his first months as president, and we're seeing it now, is it stigmatizes whole parts of the population and puts those parts of the population at risk. And as you may know, Welton, I teach in various universities in New York City and elsewhere. We're now teaching virtually. But one of the things that I have found is in those universities, students who are seen to be from other countries have been horribly treated by American students. Faculty who are seen to be from other countries have been horribly treated. And the virus is not their fault. And they are as much victims of the virus as anyone else. But one of the consequences of the kind of language that the president uses is it creates an us-them. And the philosopher of fascism, Jason Stanley at Yale University, says one of the hallmarks of fascist politics is the creation of an us and them and pitting us against them as an existential threat. We saw that in the presidency, and the kind of language the president is using now in the COVID-19 crisis is precisely the kind of language that creates an us and them.
Helio Fred Garcia is founder and president of the crisis management firm Logos Consulting Group and teaches at Columbia University and NYU. Fred has been a fixture on the Interfaith Alliance Board of Directors since 2007, and he has served as chair of the board. Fred Garcia's new book, Words on Fire, The Power of Incendiary Language and How to Confront It, will be published on June 30th. It is available now for pre-order, and we will have the benefit of his presence again in June to continue this conversation. Fred, thank you so much for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
My honor, Welton. Thank you.
We're just getting started with this week's show. With the coronavirus pandemic spreading across the globe, we'll get a first-person account from Italy-based religion journalist Elisa Di Benedetta. And later, the outgoing president of Bread for the World, the Reverend David Beckman. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. I'm Welton Gaddy. The coronavirus crisis and our government's response to it is developing by the hour. We can't hope to guess, as we record on Thursday, what the situation will be by the time you hear this. But one thing is clear. The pandemic has taken a particularly difficult toll on certain countries, and faith communities have been both impacted and energized by the crisis. A short but compelling snapshot appeared this week on the website of the International Association of Religion Journalists, headlined "Faith in a Time of Coronavirus." The piece was written by Italy-based IARJ co-managing executive director, journalist Elisa Di Benedetto, who joins us right now from that locked down country. Elisa, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Your article is from late February. So much has happened since then. What's the situation there right now?
Yeah, the situation is changing every day. So it's evolving. And over the past few days, it got worse. As you probably know, all the country now is on lockdown. And this is affecting Italian people's lives. Little things are now different. As you said, my story was published at the end of February, when only a few towns were on lockdown. So after that, there were many further restrictions by the government. And those restrictions affected both our everyday life, meaning like the relationship we have with people at work, with our friends, our families, and also our religious life. They had a big impact on that. Since the very beginning, I must admit, when people were kind of surprised when they started seeing that the churches were not closed, but they couldn't attend the liturgies and any other service there. So, like today, after the latest restrictions from yesterday, all the places are open, but only for personal prayer. So we can actually access the church, for example, but we have to make sure we are not close to other people there, and that's only for personal prayer. So churches are empty now. And when this all started, I tried to contact some people, some priests and faithful, and ask them about their feelings. And they were all surprised, as I said, and they were already missing the community, especially the elderly. So I said, okay, there are many things going on here, because journalists were covering especially some aspects like public health issue and also financial issues, especially now. But I thought that for journalists covering religion, there were many, many stories going on out there. So I started to talk to people and try to understand in what way religion's life was changing. It is leaders because they are facing many, many challenges now. Yesterday, I talked to the parish priest of a small town very close to where I live. I'm based in the north of Italy, in the northeast. And I asked him what it means for him and for other priests. And he said it's challenging. So I asked him how he is trying to support the faithful in the parish. And he said that every day he's trying to call and also to make some video calls to the people he thinks might need talking to him. And so I asked him about their reactions and what we should do now. And like many other bishops and priests, he said that this is the time for prayer, for personal prayer, and also that in these days when we are kind of reset to zero, we live of mutual love. And we should use this time to restore our spirit, to find a relationship with ourselves and with God. And this is the feeling that I found also when talking to some other people, not religious leaders, but like my neighbors. And what I could see is that this situation, the coronavirus, is changing our religious life, especially for the elderly. Because what they miss is the community and going to church. It has a lot to do with faith and religion, of course, but also with the community, with feeling part of a community, having building relationship with other people. And this is very important for the elderly. So this is another story, for example. And there's so much going on. I think nobody will ever forget the bishops or, for example, the Patriarch of Venice saying the Mass on Ash Wednesday in an empty church. And that happened in other towns and cities, and the Mass being live streamed.
My guest is religion journalist Elisa Di Benedetta, co-managing executive director of the International Association of Religion Journalists, who lives in Italy. How are people getting in touch with one another? I know what the priest said about it's a time of prayer. It's a, that can be done singularly. But how are people reaching out to each other, or are they just not reaching out to each other in this time?
Well, now, like since last night, let's say this morning, it's very hard because now we can go or going to work or going to the supermarket or the pharmacy or for something like very urgent because, for example, health issues. And if we go out, we have to carry like a signed statement where we say what's the reason why we're going out. There are some checkpoints. So it's very hard now since last night. So, for example, the people I talked to, they told me that even if they can't see each other, they know that they are together because they are praying, and so they still feel part of the community and, let's say, in touch. But it's very hard. For example, if you need to go to the pharmacy or the supermarket or the post office, you have to make sure that you are not too close to people. You have to be at least 1 meter from one another. So it's getting very hard. And I think for Italians, this is very hard. We are used to get very close to each other when we meet. So our life has really changed, and very quickly. We didn't even have the time to realize that. And the new media are helping, also with religion, because there are priests, you know, getting in touch with their on Facebook and social media. But it's not that everybody has access to this new media and social media. So some people, they are feeling alone sometimes.
Would you talk for a moment about the challenges to working as a journalist in the current circumstances?
And one of the big challenges is not to cause any anxiety. So you have to be really accurate when covering these situations. And I believe that it's very important to report on the official statements and communication, and also to tell what is going on in everyday life. So the challenges are, for example, getting in touch with people. It's very different to talk to someone on the phone than meeting a person and like sitting together and talk about the situation, especially when it's something so hard and unexpected. And then there are so many things going on, and they are evolving and changing day by day. And so it's very hard to follow everything and to be able to cover the situation and what is actually happening.
What would you want all Americans, particularly diverse persons of faith, what would you want them to know about the circumstances that you now find yourself in? So, because it may very well be that what's going on there now is coming straight to America as well, and you could give us some very helpful suggestions.
Yeah. What is very important is to make efforts together to face this situation. What I mean is that, you know, we think that maybe like a few days ago, everybody thought that maybe only the elderly would be affected by the coronavirus. And that's not true. And many people, you know, there were these restrictions and these guidelines by the government, like wash your hands very frequently, not to get too close to people. And you know, not everybody was respecting these guidelines because maybe they didn't expect the situation would get that serious. And we should really face this together. At first here, only some areas were affected by that. So it was like their problems, you know. At first it was China, and we didn't expect it would get here. And then it was only in some areas. Now the entire country is in this situation. So I believe everybody should follow the guidelines, the restrictions, the rules. Everything we do can make a change, can make a difference in the world situation for us and for our families, our friends. So I know it's very hard. We are not used to that. We will ever be used to that. But we have to make some efforts in this sense.
Do you have a sense of what the next steps might be should the pandemic continue to spread?
Well, here they are talking about that a lot. Like, for example, what happened in Italy is that they didn't close everything as it started. So they took some restrictions and then further restrictions and then further restrictions again. So, and that's because it's always changing. Then there are political parties talking about that, asking for closing even more. Now the post office is open, the banks are open, and the public transportation is working. So they are talking about a further lockdown on that too. So I don't know, because we had, for example, the first lockdown areas, they have been on lockdown for 15 days, 2 weeks. Nobody could leave those areas. And now yesterday, the news was that in one of these towns, they had no more positive cases. It was like the first day when there were no cases, no new cases of coronavirus. So maybe this is showing something. It's very, very hard. But I think the only way to contain the spread of the virus is to work together and to make efforts together.
Before we go, I really want to give you a minute or two to introduce our listeners to the International Association of Religious Journalists. Say something about the mission and how you keep the work going and how we can keep up with you.
The International Association of Religion Journalists was founded in 2012 by about 25 journalists from different regions in the world. And we are a global network of journalists promoting excellence in the coverage of religion and spirituality. We are encouraging religion reporting and trying to expand the global network. Over 700 members in the association, and we are trying to enhance the joint project reporting. For example, now our team is trying to collect quotes and statements by religion leaders in different regions about coronavirus, and this is very challenging. We are trying to cover religion news stories through the religion data resources and training, ethical guidelines. And for us, it's very important to create a network of journalists working on these issues.
Elisa Di Benedetto is co-managing executive director of the International Association of Religion Journalists, based in the Veneto region of Italy, a country now locked down in response to the global pandemic. Elisa published her piece, Faith in a Time of Coronavirus, on the IARJ website. Elisa, thank you so much for being with us on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much.
Bread for the World has been a remarkably effective and respected policy advocacy organization, and one that we have turned to a number of times for credible insights on matters of poverty and hunger. Since 1991, the Reverend Dr. David Beckman has served as president, and he's now announced his retirement. We wanted to take this opportunity to spend a little time talking about his long history of leadership and discuss the future global activism in an increasingly fractured world. And so, David, it's always been good to hear your voice. You have inspired us. You have informed us. And it is so good to have you back on State of Belief Radio.
Well, Walton, I always appreciate you. You're a great colleague and friend over many years, and I appreciate what you're doing now. So thanks for having me.
What made you think this was the right time to pass the torch?
Well, I just think, I've been doing it almost 30 years in one role, and so it seems like the right time to let the board recruit the next generation of leadership. And they just did hire the Reverend Eugene Cho. People can check him out online. He's really a spectacular Christian leader. He's a Korean-American, has that whole background of Korea's dramatic reduction of poverty mm-hmm. over the last generation, being an immigrant. He relied on social safety net programs for a while. And then he built a wonderful, remarkably diverse church in Seattle, and he's been running a grassroots group that's raising money for good projects in poor countries. So he's here this week at Bread for the World. It's his first week. He just got chosen on Monday, Eugene Cho. But I think he'll be a shot in the arm for Bread for the World and take us the next 20 years.
Well, you'll be glad to know that we're going to have him on State of Belief. I don't remember the date, but he will be on with us.
He's dynamite. I know of him. I've known of him, but I haven't known him until I really got to know him a little bit this week.
And yeah,
he's great.
Well, he's filling a big pair of shoes.
They're 10.5 feet, not too tough.
David, I know your time leading Bread for the World is rich in achievements and significant progress. Let's begin with you talking about one or two initiatives that you are proudest of or that you consider most important.
I'd highlight two things that Bread for the World has done. I think we played a really crucial role in expanding and improving U.S. government assistance that's focused on, in different ways, on reducing poverty in the world. We haven't done that by ourselves by any means. But since I started in 1991 at Bread for the World, the dollar amount of the aid programs that are focused, that are related to poverty, has quadrupled. And there have also been dramatic improvements in the quality. And Bread for the World and its members and churches across the country have been involved in every step of that. And it's contributed to dramatic reductions in hunger and poverty. When in 1991, about 25% of the world's people were hungry, it's now down to about 10%.
Mm.
Again, what the U.S. has done, we're part of something bigger God is doing, those people are doing, but we have been a significant part. The other thing I take real satisfaction in is that we have helped to provide leadership within the faith community to push back against a massive political effort to make deep, deep cuts in all the programs that provide help and opportunity to people in need. Since 2011, every budget that's passed between 2011 and 2018, every budget that passed either House of Congress proposed cuts of about $2 trillion over 10 years. In programs that are means-tested, that go mainly to poor people, SNAP, mm-hmm. WIC, Medicaid. And we've been a small but significant player in saying no to that. And I've been gratified that over that period, Christian leaders of all stripes, conservative, liberal, white, black, Latino, Catholic Protestants have said, no, don't, you know, our deficit's not because we're doing too much for poor people. You know, don't cut those programs. If you want to make some of them better or shift money from one to the other, fine, but don't cut. And I think that united witness of many Christian leaders and Muslims and Jews has led to, in fact, there have been virtually no cuts to the federal programs that are focused on poor people. Yeah. And then, you know, with the defeat of the push for $1 trillion in cuts from Medicaid in 2018, when that was defeated by one vote in the Senate, that really ended that push. So in last year in 2019, actually Congress approved the first increases in poverty-focused programs since 2010. Mm. Now President Trump's trying to cut programs without help from Congress. You know, what can they do on their own to cut programs? And so we're fighting that battle. But so far we've been able to really minimize the damage of what could have been could have impoverished a lot of communities all over the country. It's been tough enough without that.
Yes. Let me look at the other side of that. Is there one thing you would say is your biggest disappointment or just a goal you wish you'd been able to meet or meet sooner?
Well, I think the big disappointment, I mean, we've been on the domestic side, groups like Bread for the World have been mainly focused on defense, you know, pushing against efforts to make life harder for poor people working people, you know, by cutting government, anything government related that helps folks. So we've played defense pretty effectively. But, you know, meanwhile, the wages of working class, low income people have been stagnant or declining for decades now. Mm-hmm. And we haven't seen any substantial decrease in poverty mm-hmm. since 1975. Mm-hmm. Between 65 and 75, the country cut poverty in half because we tried. Yeah. You know, we had a good economy. Then, you know, they set up the Great Society programs. That wasn't just the Democrats. That Richard Nixon was responsible for leading the establishing the food stamp program. So as a country, we tried, as a country, as a nation, not just through the local food bank, but as a nation, to do what we could to reduce poverty. And we did a lot. But since 1975, there's been virtually no improvement, no reduction in poverty. And more generally, working class people have been stuck or worse. And so that's a huge disappointment. And it's then contributed to real anger and you know, who do you blame? Do you blame the billionaires or do you blame black people? Mm-hmm. And you know, some people have been motivated to you know, the whole Trumpism movement. It's not just Republican Democrats, but there's a vitriol and anger and hatred in the movement of Trumpism, and some of that is rooted in the frustration of the justified frustration of a lot of working class white people.
Yeah,
that's a big disappointment. It's something we got to fix.
Yeah,
we got to go back and do that better.
How is the work of fighting global hunger different today than it was when you started almost three decades ago?
Well, the big change, of course, the big change is that there's been a dramatic reduction in hunger, poverty, and disease in the world. The biggest reduction in human history. And the whole world recognizes that. In 1990-91, there were roughly 2 billion people mm-hmm. in absolute poverty. That's now down to about 700 million. So it's you know, almost down to a third of what it was.
Yeah.
And it's hard to ignore that. You know, and you go to places like Bangladesh or Ethiopia. Mm-hmm. Ethiopia has reduced poverty. Almost all the kids are in school. You know, up in the zone where they've had recurrent famine over the decades, they've really worked to reforest, and they've actually been able to raise the groundwater under that area, Tigray, so farmers can be more productive. I mean, if they can avoid fighting each other, Ethiopia doesn't ever need to have another famine because they really, in various ways, they've got that situation under better control. So that's a huge change, and everybody sees it. You know, the Sustainable Development Goals were endorsed by all the nations of the world. The Pope came over and on that day when they did that, and everybody knows that it is feasible to end poverty, end hunger. We could virtually end hunger by 2030. You know, that's not very much time. It is not that hard to do. It doesn't take a revolution or even a lot of money in terms of course it's a lot of money, but given how much money we throw around for so many purposes, it's not a lot of money relatively. And so that sense of hope, also poor people know that around the world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they may not know the numbers, but they listen to the radio and they know that it would be a lot better if their girls could go to school. So they're willing to sacrifice to get their boys and girls into grade school and get them as far as they can. And they know that a rural road could transform their lives. So I just think in general, that sense of hope is a huge change.
Mm-hmm.
And at Bread for the World, we've come to see that this tremendous liberation of the last generation is like the exodus of the Bible. It's, the people of Israel went through that liberation from slavery, and they said, you know, that was the Lord. And I think this great global exodus is an experience of the Lord in our time. This is our loving God moving in our own time and also inviting us to get with the program, you know, to really all of us to be part. And also, if you can do that, and if you can do what Ethiopia and Bangladesh have done to make things better for people at the bottom, there is just no excuse for still in our country, 1 in 5 kids lives in a household that runs out of food. You could fix that in 3 years. So let's do it.
Yeah. David, I have always thought that a signature tactic of your work has been bipartisanship. As
right.
difficult as it seems to have become to cross ever-deepening divides, I think it would be invaluable to hear your thoughts on that particular issue.
Yeah, I mean, in the country, it's not like one side or the other. I mean, basically, a third of the people are Republicans, a third are Democrats, and a third are independents. So one side or the other, one party or the other, you can't write the others off because, you know, they'll be back. So, you know, if you pass something on a partisan basis, there's a pretty good chance that it'll disappear within 4 years or 5 years. So what's happening right now is really exciting. Secretary Mnuchin, the Secretary of Treasury in the Trump administration, is working really hard with Nancy Pelosi to see if within the next 48 hours, if they can't come up with a bipartisan emergency package to help the economy, help people cope with the coronavirus. It's wonderful how, you know, puts sort of the coronavirus has maybe put the fear of God into us.
Yeah.
And it just is possible that both sides will be able to put together a short-term package that can become law and this week and start helping people right away. So
mm-hmm.
that's an example of how bipartisanship is really often crucial to getting something done and even more crucial to making it stick. I mean, if one side or the other is wrong, is brutal, you got to say it.
Mm-hmm.
I think you have to speak the truth, love everybody. A Catholic bishop one time, so I asked the Catholic bishop how to maintain bipartisanship and in this environment. He said, tell the truth, yeah. Love everybody, and tell the truth.
Well, you were a genius as well as a prophet in making that happen.
We're still working on it. You know, we're working now on Bread for the World's main campaign is focused on global child malnutrition because we have new knowledge about how to reduce malnutrition. We know how to do it. Over the last 10 years, the number of stunted kids in the world has dropped by 22 million. It doesn't cost very much money. So we decided in this tough political environment to focus on that and try to get broad bipartisan support for continued leadership in reducing malnutrition around the world. And so churches and communities across the country have rallied around that, and a lot of churches are afraid to bring up any policy issue, any political issue, because they're afraid that's going to divide the congregation. You know, on this one, who's going to go to church and not be willing to sign a letter to their member of Congress about giving nutrition to babies, for right. God's sake? You know, and we've passed nutrition legislation now has been, I mean, we had 200 members of Congress, including people from both sides, have co-sponsored a resolution. It's passed the full Senate. The last thing they did before they started the impeachment trial was a unanimous approval of the global nutrition resolution. Now it had to go through two committees in the Senate. It just passed the Agriculture Committee last week. So I think I don't know what's going to happen about how long Congress is going to stay in session, but if they stay in session a while, we'll get it through the full House. So it's an example of we really designed it to make it hard not to work together, and it's helped us work together.
I think it's fair to say that empathy for people in faraway countries is harder to muster today than it was decades ago. For starters, the nationalism promoted by leaders of a growing number of countries is antithetical to a global view of human suffering. How are organizations like Bread for the World adopting to that trend?
Well, I'm not sure. You know, some of it's generational. I mean, I think younger people, younger adults get that the world's global and our country is more, you know, it's our country includes a lot of people from all over the world. And in the next generation, it's hard to generalize. But in general, younger people know and are friends with people from all over the world. Mm. So I think it's true that the president really promotes this America First idea, but it's bunk. It's just that is not it. And I think, the coronavirus again is, just if we had any doubt that the human family is interconnected.
Yes.
This delivers that message with power. I'm terrified that. We haven't done what we could to build up health systems in Africa, and it's starting to move across Africa. It'll just rip across Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And, you don't stop it at the borders. You just can't. You can't just say, oh, no flights from Africa, and that won't stop it.
Yeah.
It's a virus, and it moves just a few people, any kind of contact, and it can move, and so it'll come back to bite us. And I think the reality is in terms of health, in terms of peace, in terms of prosperity, we are one human family in this country. You know, if we make it impossible for undocumented people in this country to get health care, to get tested for coronavirus, that'll bite us, everybody.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And if we don't do our best in an emergency situation to provide help to countries around the world in coping with this thing, it'll come back and bite us. So I think just reality is on our side. You know, we are interdependent, and it is the truth, it is God's truth, that we are interconnected, and we ignore that at our peril. You know, if, of course, we can go ahead and do dumb things. You know, we can ignore climate change. We can ignore poor people in parts of the world, but there's a punishment for that. Yeah. And, you know, it'll wake us up eventually, I hope.
David, one last question, and I'm glad that my wife is not listening to me ask this question. We all say we're going to retire and we're going to rest and we're going to relax and we're going to do this and that.
I never said that.
And then invariably we find ourselves here as engaged as circumstances allow. So what are your real plans once you pass the baton this summer?
Yeah, I think I'm retiring from Bread for the World, from the leadership of Bread for the World, but my successor, Eugene Cho, and my and the board envision a supportive role for me as you have. Well, I don't need to be the boss to be helpful. And and then I'm going to start a new a digital learning network on how to change the politics of poverty. What else can we do to shift it? You know, if we could just shift our politics a little bit, we could get much better outcomes for people at the bottom and for all of us. And so I can even give you the – it's not up today, but I think in a week it'll be up. It's davidbeckman.net.
Good.
And what I hope is that people who are interested in that, who feel that challenge, will connect with davidbeckman.net. It's with two N's. But so I hope they'll connect with davidbeckman.net and with me in social media, and that we can create a new learning community where people who have good ideas, good experience moving us in the right direction can share ideas. So that's my new plan.
The Reverend Dr. David Beckman is the longtime president of Bread for the World, a collective Christian voice urging our nation's decision makers to end hunger at home and abroad. He also serves as president of the Alliance to End Hunger. Reverend Beckman's latest book is titled Exodus from Hunger, We Are Called to Change the Politics of Hunger. David, I celebrate your three decades of leadership at Bread for the World. You bring me great gratitude for you and for what you've done, such leadership as you have given to all of our nation. And the activism that you have demonstrated yourself in so many different ways. I look forward to hearing more about what you're doing now and the energy that you have for doing what's next, I believe in, and we'll be wanting to hear about it here on State of Belief Radio.
Well, thank you, Welton. I appreciate it. I mean, I don't want to say the same thing. You know, we're very parallel in the sense that you're president emeritus of Interfaith Alliance. You've kept going with state of belief and in a great way. You know, it's what you're doing now is a great blessing to people. So you keep it up, and so will I.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, let me say a very sincere thank you. Your generous support of this program is vital, vital to keeping us on the air. If you think there's value in what you've heard here, and you think it's important that others hear it as well, please make your contribution today. Find more information at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. And by the way, do you know someone who you think might benefit from hearing what you're hearing, please commit to sharing State of Belief with just one person this week. It is incredibly helpful to know that we are reaching more and more people, especially at a time such as this. Stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. And take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Be a part of the conversation. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. I know this is a tough time. I know it is somewhat a scary time. If you get out, be careful where you go. And we'll get back together again next week. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That State of Belief.
I think it's time we stop, children. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.